This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww.
You know, as a ecologist who's really committed to, you know, saving the environment, but, you know, had kind of all this training in sort of the wonders of chemistry and, you know, how important, you know, chemicals are, the what we're all made of. It was a really wild experience to be sort of participating in some of those debates.
It's a show about medicine.
Now free of ethnic slurs.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're going to look at the evidence behind medical topics. And the show is
called... Wait. No, I want to say it.
I want to say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of... It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
We are joined by Dr. Effie Greathouse, who has a PhD in ecology and who is one half of the Fluoride Exposed website, dedicated to making science related to water, health, teeth, and of course, fluoride more transparent, accessible, and fun. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I have a question just based on your name. What kind of house do you live in? Is it like a condo? Is it like a cottage? Is it like a Tudor? Like what do you, what's the architecture
how
like?
How great is your house?
Yeah, I'm genuinely curious.
I live in the standard 3-bedroom single family home. I do have a really great garden that I think makes my house reach the great level.
I see. Do you have tomatoes in your garden? That's really the metric that we use to judge that sort of thing, at least when you're here in Montreal, because tomatoes is something we take very seriously around here.
I have no tomatoes, but I have incredible blueberries because Oregon is blueberry country.
I see. Okay. Oh,
interesting. So speaking of picking apart names, your website is called Fluoride Exposed. And I'm sure many of our listeners will wonder if we have maybe invited onto our show someone who does not want fluoride in the water supply, a sort of Alex Jones proxy on the fluoride issue. Could you tell us what your stance is on fluoride and health and why you named your project Fluoride Exposed?
Yeah, so our mission is to communicate the scientific consensus around fluoride in terms of when we explore all health questions. So we're looking to expose all the facts that CDC and the American Dental Association and, you know, science-based researchers have determined about fluoride's key role in cavity prevention. And our name is poking a little fun at the conspiracy thinking at the same time that, you know, some of the science is behind paywalls or it's really long and technical. So we want to bring sort of more exposure and bring more daylight to all the scientific facts that can sort of be hidden in those big walls of text that the scientific papers can be.
So I guess very basic question here. So what is the reasoning for adding fluoride to drinking water?
And basically maybe just explain what fluoride is, what its atomic number is, what happens when you put it in a particle accelerator, like really get into the molecular chemistry of it. Like what is
fluoride? How many grams per mole?
Yeah.
So I don't know if I can do any particle accelerator details, but fluoride is the major ion of one of the elements on the periodic table, fluorine. It's the 9th element on the periodic table. And that makes it one of the building blocks of everything in the universe. And that ionic fluoride that's had one electron taken away in the form of toothpaste or in water, when it's at sort of the right amount, a very low level of it, when teeth are exposed to that fluoride, when we brush our teeth, when we drink fluoridated water that has just a little tiny bit of those fluoride ions in it, then that fluoride interacts with our enamel and it kicks hydroxyl out of our of the hydroxyapatite in our tooth enamel, and then it fluoride sort of replaces it and then forms fluorapatite, and that fluorapatite in our enamel is then less soluble in acid. Tooth decay bacteria like to feed on the same sugars that we're eating, and then they produce acid as a byproduct of their fermentation of those sugars, and that acid can then eat away at our enamel, causing tooth decay. So fluoride provides sort of these three mechanisms of protection against those acid attacks that can occur throughout the day as we're eating our meals and having sugar or other cariogenic foods. So fluoride can directly inhibit the bacteria and their production of acid. But then, as I said, it the fluoride remineralizes our teeth with fluorapatite when there's been a little bit of the acid eating away at the enamel. And then the fluorapatite that forms is then less soluble the next time around. So it inhibits demineralization. And a particularly cool thing to me about fluoride and water and fluoridated water is that then sort of that modality for oral health protection with fluoride is occurring throughout the day. So whenever you're drinking water, you are getting a little bit of that fluoride to combat the effects of the acid, as opposed to brushing your teeth, they're recommended twice a day. You know, that's sort of, you know, once in the morning, once in the evening. Fluoridated water has this potential to be providing this protection all day long.
So was that the rationale for putting fluoride in drinking water as opposed to making it, a supplement of some other food source? Because there are foods that are supplemented with various things. I'm thinking folic acid in grains, as one example. So was that the reason specifically for putting fluoride in water as opposed to something else?
I'd say that that's more of a benefit of fluoridated water that's become, came to be understood over the years. And the origin story of fluoridated water is extremely fascinating to me with my background in water quality and my training as a stream ecologist. Our fluoride in water is how we know about fluoride as a cavity prevention, cavity fighter. Back in the 1920s and 1930s, dental researchers were working on figuring out what was going on in some cities where their years of research determined that brown stains on kids' teeth in cities in Colorado and some cities in Texas were being caused by too much fluoride. But they also observed that sort of, right at the right amount of fluoride in the water, those kids had way fewer cavities than anyone else. And that led to the idea of, hey, if we add just a tiny bit of fluoride to drinking water in cities where the level is extremely low, we are going to see cavity prevention, at a time when cavities were just rampant, where it was, common for teenagers to have all teeth pulled and have to get dentures because cavities were so bad.
One of the arguments one of the things that I hear people say about fluoride is, well, let's not put it in drinking water. Let's put it in toothpaste. That would be better. But basically what you're trying to say is that there's actually an advantage to it being in water rather than just in toothpaste, that it's a better way to deliver fluoride to the population, if I've understood you correctly.
I would say that the current recommendations are you should brush twice a day with fluoride toothpaste, mm-hmm. and you should drink fluoridated water, and that it's a little bit like seatbelts and airbags. This is an analogy that other oral health folks have made, that they both provide sort of different types of protection towards the same end of healthy teeth. there is absolutely advantage that fluoridated water has in terms of that, you know, providing some protection all throughout the day that, you know, just isn't feasible with toothbrushing.
Some people will choose to buy fluoride-free toothpaste. Is there any good reason for that, or is that just an unreasonable fear of fluoride?
I do think that fluoride-free toothpaste is, especially in when used by adults, is born from a fear of fluoride that's just not based in what the evidence shows. There has been sort of changes over the years in what's recommended for babies and toddlers. 20 years ago, it was standard advice for under 2 years old to use a training toothpaste that didn't have fluoride in it. And that's partly based on a baby can't spit out the pea-size amount of fluoride that, you know, we brush typically with our toothpaste. But in 2014, the American Dental Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, they really did this big review on the evidence base for fluoride toothpaste and what they want to guard against for kids not getting too much fluoride. And they came up with new recommendations based on, you know, new understanding of the science that their recommendation now is for, from the very first tooth that a baby gets to age 3, to use a rice grain sized smear of fluoride toothpaste. And then at age 3 to start using a pea size amount of fluoride toothpaste. And then at age 3 is when you can kind of start to teach a kid to spit out, and that they, you know, can start to work on those muscles to like not automatically swallow it.
I mean, I'm sure that through your work in science communication, you've spoken to people who, you know, oppose fluoridation or are scared by it. I mean, what are the arguments that that they will use against you? Is fluoride, in fact, a communist plot, as was explained in the movie Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb? Like, what are the things that people are particularly worried about?
There is definitely a lot of misinformation out there, a lot of conspiracy theories, but there's also a lot of genuine questions where folks are confused. So, for example, you know, coming back to toothpaste, you'll commonly see folks be confused about fluoride toothpaste saying, do not swallow. And then, you know, wonder like, well, if I'm not supposed to swallow fluoride toothpaste, why is it recommended to be put in water that I'm going to be drinking? And, that's not so much of a conspiracy theory. It's kind of like a good question. You know, what's the science behind that? And, you know, I think it's, you know, that's legitimately confusing and can be explained by, you know, the chemistry and how much more fluoride is in toothpaste than the very tiny amounts in water. And there is the issue of that we need to guard against folks getting too much fluoride, while we also don't want folks to get too little fluoride. You know, there's sort of this right amount that's a good amount, just like any other vitamin. You know, if you sort of overdose on any vitamin, it's going to be unhealthy and have risks of, you know, poisoning issues. So that's at play with fluoride toothpaste as well, of, you know, why there's a do not swallow warning on there.
I wanted to throw something out there, and we can discuss it in however much detail we want. But for example, there are studies out there that will seem to show detrimental effects of fluoride exposure in certain contexts. We were talking before the show, for example, there was a Canadian study in 2019, reporting on a seeming association between maternal fluoride exposure during pregnancy and IQ scores in their babies. Is this something that you hear about a lot? What do you make of these kinds of claim? Is this something that is scaring parents that come to you, for example, when they have questions about fluoride exposure during pregnancy?
Absolutely. I think that the ongoing research on IQ is really out there as a concern among parents. and can cause a lot of confusion as well. And I originally got started in really looking deeply at fluoride with looking at some of those claims. How we got started in this is I'm from Portland, Oregon, and we are the last city in the last large city in the United States to not fluoridate our water. And we had a fluoridation campaign back when my daughter was about 9 or 10 months old. And I got recruited to, and this was before I was doing any of this work. You know, the experience of this campaign really inspired me to start working in this area. So I got recruited to write an op-ed. They had asked me to kind of look at some of the IQ claims. And as part of that, I, you know, to really do my research on writing this op-ed, I read the IQ study at the time that would make such big headlines and sort of be blown out of proportion in the comment sections, in the moms groups online, and in the media, the Choi et al. Meta-analysis of the studies from China purporting to show a relationship between fluoride exposure and IQ. And when I read that study, you know, my takeaway was that there are some legitimate questions here to research. There is a correlation here, but none of these studies reach a level of quality that anyone should be basing their health decisions on. There is so many confounding factors. The studies involved there had so many quality issues. It's still the case to this day that the research base has not reached a level of quality to reach any sort of scientific consensus. Some of the authors on those studies are also, you know, are not recommending any changes and still drink fluoridated water in their families.
Chris, I mean, you remember when that particular study came out. I mean, there have been others, but like, what broadly speaking, what did you make of it?
I think one of the big issues that you have when you have studies like this is that it's often not what people think it is. People often think it's like, oh, well, they gave, you know, they gave fluoride or they gave fluoridated water to these pregnant women. And then they waited to see, you know, what's going to happen with the IQ scores of their kids once they entered kindergarten. They did this for like 5 years. And that's actually usually not what happened. It's usually, excuse me, it's sometimes retrospective, but they're sort of measuring fluoride exposure in an indirect way. And in particular with the 2019 study that came out of here in Canada, what they basically did was they looked at what neighborhood, what city you lived in, looked at whether your particular municipality puts fluoride in the drinking water, estimated what the average fluoride concentration is going to be, had a food questionnaire to assess how much, you know, how many glasses of water you drank in a day. And we've talked many times before about how food questionnaires are very, very inaccurate, especially when you're asking people to remember back to stuff they did in the distant past. So, you know, you're sort of saying, okay, well, there's this much fluoride in water. You drink this much water over the course of the day. This is probably how much fluoride you were exposed to. Let's tie it with the IQ score in your kids, which is itself a problematic metric and doesn't actually reflect what people think it reflects. So there's so many issues with the study. And when you sort of, you know, tease it out, you realize, well, this is not really as definitive as it appears at first blush. And, you know, I think the onus should be on people to prove that this is problematic, not on somebody else to prove them wrong. And this is sort of a problem with research. People will put out, you know, non-definitive, preliminary, you want to call it preliminary, you want to call it hypothesis generating, but they put out a piece of research like, well, we're not saying stop fluoride, but, you know, here's stop putting fluoride in water, but here's one of the issues. And it's like, well, no, listen, if you're going to advocate for reversing a public health policy, which is water fluoridation, which we've been doing in this Canada since the mid-40s, and bonus points if you can tell me which city was the first city in Canada to start fluoridating their drinking water. But if you're going to reverse
Montreal, because we still don't have fluoride,
it's not Montreal. No, but certain parts of the West Island in Montreal do put fluoride in the drinking water.
Ah,
so it's not okay. Uniform across the island. That's what makes this stuff really, really difficult to sort of tease out. Like it could even not be uniform within the same city, because sometimes it's handled differently, as it is in Montreal. But it's like you know, when you look at the actual details, like, here's the thing: if you're going to advocate for reversing a public health policy, you have to have good data to back it up. And I'm not saying don't do the research, but instead of doing these sort of like association studies and, you know, asking, trying to assess it indirectly with food questionnaires, if this is a valid question, which I personally don't really think it is, but if you think it's a valid question, do the study definitively, and then we'll put the issue to bed and not talk about it anymore. But this sort of constant regurgitation of this issue doesn't really accomplish anything. It just creates doubt in the public's mind.
In addition, some of the best research on IQ has indicated there is no problem at all. Broadbent et al. From research in New Zealand. There's been research in Sweden. There was just a paper that came out yesterday. Researchers in Spain who are, you know, finding the opposite, that there's either no relationship between fluoride and IQ, or even finding sometimes positive relationships.
And one of the other problems too is, sort of, I didn't get into it, but, you know, they'll show like a difference of IQ score of like 2 or 3 points, let's say, which, you know, meets statistical significance, but your IQ score, when you look at a standard deviation, is usually about 15 points. A 2 to 3 point change in IQ doesn't mean anything clinically. It doesn't, you know, it's so, again, it's the issue of, you know, using surrogate markers. It's the issue of statistical significance as opposed to clinical significance. So there's a lot of problems here. And, you know, for people who hold up these studies, they are not smoking guns to show that fluoride is dangerous. At best, they sort of create doubt. But, you know, creating doubt by studies that have methodological shortcomings isn't a good way to be doing science.
I wanted to ask you, Effie, I see a fair amount of overlap between the public debate over fluoridation and COVID-19, because in both cases, there can be a clash between public health, right, and the privileged notion that is often embraced by the wellness movement of, well, health is actually a personal responsibility. So if I'm healthy, it's because I've made the right choices. And if I'm sick, I've only got myself to blame. This sort of individualistic, sometimes even libertarian approach to health doesn't really mesh very well with public health now, does it?
Absolutely. And it's been really fascinating to me to do this work, to learn a lot more about public health and different kinds of public health measures. I originally did a PhD in ecology. I was working on conservation questions related to freshwater shrimps and dams in tropical island streams. But I also was doing water quality related work. Then was this new mom when fluoridation became this big hot button issue in our city. And I was in all these online moms groups, seeing these debates go down in those groups about, first of all, before the fluoridation campaign came up in our city, I was seeing these debates in my mom's groups about vaccination and sunscreen. Mm-hmm. And in Portland, Oregon, we have a lot of moms who are into natural health and kind of, you know, don't want any chemicals around. And, mm-hmm. you know, as a ecologist who's really committed to, you know, saving the environment, but, you know, had kind of all this training in sort of the wonders of chemistry and, you know, how important, you know, chemicals are, the what we're all made of. It was a really wild experience to be sort of participating in some of those debates, and then for fluoridation to blow up and be seeing just so much misconception about water and drinking water, and then, you know, when the pandemic hit, to sort of have this front row seat to what the public health professionals are facing and trying to communicate during this, you know, fast moving, difficult pandemic has been, you know, really incredible.
Do you think that parenting has become harder in terms of wading through misinformation and pseudoscience, in terms of all the scares that are out there about quote unquote chemicals and toxins and what you should be exposed to, what you shouldn't be exposed to? Do you think that the internet maybe has fed anxieties in soon to be parents that are not justified?
I do. At the same time, that I think that the internet has been an incredible source of helpful information to parents. My experience in the moms groups was, you know, that there were some of these frustrating debates, but it was also such a key source of support and, you know, learning a chance to learn details about things that I had questions on, really sort of both our frustration with, but also our understanding of sort of the necessity and of using, quote, Dr. Google underlies this work that we're doing. You know, there's been so many times when I've been in a well child visit with our doctor and there's just not enough time to ask all the questions I want to ask or, you know, get into the details behind something I don't understand. And being able to go to the internet and read, you know, good science-based resources on it so that I understand the details has been, you know, so extremely valuable. Or, you know, if it's, you know, midnight and, you know, you're seeing some symptoms and you're kind of freaked out and you're waiting for the advice nurse to call you back and, you know, there's five other moms who are up, you know, nursing their babies at the same time. And, you know, you can throw in a post to sort of get some reassurance and calm down a little bit. That type of thing is so valuable. So there is all this pseudoscience out there that causes confusion and fears. But, you know, it's, I guess it's kind of like the baby with and the bathwater. And is part of why we're doing what we're doing is that we sort of recognize that, you know, Dr. Google is not going away. These moms groups where moms connect with each other online, you know, that's not going away. Let's work to make sure we have better information on the internet. If moms need and, you know, dads need sort of detailed information to sort of understand that one thing that they have a little fear about, fluoride toothpaste or this one thing that doesn't make sense to them, like let's try to get more articles up online that make sense of those things for them.
We were discussing earlier people who you know, have questions about fluoride or who buy into conspiracy theories about fluoridation of water. On your website Fluoride Exposed, you talk about the phrase anti-science, which I rarely use myself. I've seen scientists use it during the pandemic. I don't really like it, but you write about this phrase, anti-science. You write about empathy. You quote Carl Sagan. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this, about what your stance is on this particular phrase.
Yeah, we have as part of our sort of philosophy and how we run things at Fluoride Exposed is that we don't call anyone anti-science. We don't really think that folks are anti-science. We do talk about pseudoscience. I think that, you know, there's misinformation out there and it's way more likely to be pseudoscience that folks are confused that, you know, they think they have opinion or a fact that's based in science and it's not, you know, what the evidence is showing. But we don't really see people as against science. Even going through this pandemic with all the misinformation that's out there, the folks who are, you know, spreading that misinformation, they think that it's, you know, what they're claiming is based on science. They're often using science as, you know, a basis for making that claim. So yeah, we try to really stay grounded in having compassion for how hard it can be to parse out all the details in this modern information world where maybe a lot of times what's more going on is like a giant game of telephone and, you know, recognition that especially amongst parents and moms trying to make decisions for their families, that everyone's trying to do the best they can.
Well, you never answered my question about which is the first city in Canada to start using, to start fluoridating drinking water. And as a bonus question, what two famous Canadians came from that city? I feel like the people want to know this, Jonathan.
I feel like they don't. Let me guess. Was it Ottawa?
Nope.
It wasn't. Was it a big city?
Not an especially big city, no.
Winnipeg.
No.
Was it in Quebec?
No.
Was it in Ontario?
It was.
It was in Ontario.
Effie, you should feel free to jump in at any time. I presume that you know quite a bit about Canadian history.
So was Brantford the control city, or was that the...
No, that's the answer. That's the answer. It's Brantford, Ontario. You got it right. Jonathan, your ignorance sickens me. It sickens me.
Ontario is like a giant gray blob on my mental map of Canada. It's like it's a big thing over there. There's Toronto there. There's Ottawa. It's closer. Mm-hmm. The rest, I don't know.
Yeah, so Brantford, Ontario is about an hour and 10 minutes out of Toronto by car, a little bit past Hamilton if you're heading in that direction. Two very famous Canadians to come out of that city, actually. Effie, if you want to further embarrass Jonathan, now would be your chance.
I have no idea who the famous Canadians out of Brantford are, but we have...
I bet you, but I will guarantee that you've... Well, I think there's a very good chance that you will have heard their names, very possibly.
Are they actors?
No, but they have international clout. One more than the other.
This is riveting stuff, Chris.
Yeah, one who is still alive and one who is long dead but had a major impact on the history of the world and technology by inventing a very, very important piece of technology.
Hmm.
See, if you had driven by that area, you would have seen the signs like Brantford, Ontario, home of, you know, so and so and so and so.
I don't know, Chris. What is the answer to your trivia question?
So Alexander Graham Bell was from Brantford, Ontario, was Wayne Gretzky.
I see.
So Alexander Graham Bell, inventor of the telephone. Some debate about who was the actual inventor of the telephone. There were many patent fights over this issue, but at the end of the day, he holds the patent, so he's going down in the history books. So Alexander Graham Bell. And Wayne Gretzky, arguably one of the greatest hockey players of all time. So there you go.
But does he have a chain of donut shops to his name?
He does not, but I think he probably has more money than he knows what to do with, so I don't feel like he needs to engage in that particular brand of commercial enterprise.
I was referring, of course, to Tim Horton.
Yeah, a famous coffee chain in Canada for international listeners.
It's the Dunkin' Donuts of Canada is what it is.
Yep.
Well, I want to throw in to the mix that Grand Rapids, Michigan gets all this love for being, you know, the first city that fluoridated and this key part of the science history that, you know, that fluoridation trial came at the end of years of research on, you know, epidemiological research on the patterns of fluorosis and tooth decay against natural fluoride in water. And then, you know, there were these cutting edge studies done during these fluoridation trials in Michigan. Muskegon was the control city and Grand Rapids was the city where they were fluoridating. And, you know, it was just a few months later that Newburgh, New York, you know, fluoridated too in Brantford, Ontario. And there were four cities total that did, you know, started these fluoridation trials that are really part of those historic studies that were done that were really cutting edge at the time. So I always feel like Brantford does not get enough love for their important role in the history of fluoridation.
So you hear that, people of Brantford? And I know we have at least one. I know we have at least one listener from Brantford, Ontario. So to all of our listeners in Brantford, we love you, even if your contributions to medical history go largely unacknowledged. But we love you here at the Body of Evidence.
Effie, if people want to find you and your work online, where do they go?
Our website is fluorideexposed.org. We also are on Facebook at facebook.com/explorefluoride. If you search in Facebook for Fluoride Exposed, you would find us as well. And we're on Twitter under @fluorideexposed. We also just started up on Pinterest. So you can find Fluoride Exposed pinning for science there.
But you're not on TikTok dancing for fluoride.
I have it on my to-do list to try to secure our TikTok handle, But I have not figured
out. Do it before the episode comes out, though, because one of our listeners might steal it from you and sell it back to you at a higher price. Mm.
And if people want to meet you in real life, can you provide us with your home address, please?
Please
no,
don't.
But folks are welcome to reach out to me at hello@fluorideexposed.org.
Well, Dr. Effie Greathouse, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy, proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at
the body of evidence.